Palestinian rights group says last year's Israeli shelling of a warehouse in Gaza ignited hundreds of tons of chemicals in a northern town. A top NATO official says that the Western Military Alliance is no longer bound by past commitments to hold back from having robust posture in Eastern Europe. Two more Turkish soldiers are killed in northern Iraq. This as Ankara is pushing ahead with its offensive against Kurdish militants near its borders. Hi, everybody. I'm Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. A Palestinian rights group has accused Israel of war crimes over its shelling of a warehouse in Gaza during its attack on the Strip last year. A study by a group, Al-Haq, says that the Israeli shelling ignited hundreds of tons of chemicals in the warehouse in the northern Gaza town of Beit Lahia, even though no fighting was going on nearby. Al-Haq calls the Israeli shelling, quote, chemical warfare by indirect means. The report quotes residents as saying that they suffered from diarrhea, vomiting, and intense stomach pain after the attack. Al-Haq says the attack deliberately targeted civilian, economic, and industrial infrastructure in Gaza. The Beit Lahia warehouse is the largest of its kind in the Gaza Strip. Al-Haq is the leading group providing information to the International Criminal Court in The Hague on alleged Israeli war crimes and crimes against humanity. Israeli settlers have held their flag march in the occupied Al-Quds city, and despite prior warnings by Palestinians who regard the parade as provocative, the settlers crossed the Damascus Gate, then marched through the old city's Muslim Square, and that amid Palestinians' warning of retaliation. A correspondent has a report.
Some 30,000 Israeli settlers marched through Al-Quds and its old town while chanting anti-Arab and anti-Muslim slogans as part of what's known by Israel as the Flag March that takes place annually to celebrate its occupation of the eastern parts of the Holy City in 1967. Thousands also marched through the Muslim quarter of the old town of Al-Quds amid security deployment and restrictions against the Palestinians. Clashes broke out at the Bab al-Amud, known also as the Damascus Gate, multiple times ahead of the march. Dozens of Palestinians were wounded and arrested by the Israeli forces.
Israel is conducting a very dangerous policy. They are trying to impose the annexation of East Jerusalem, which presents a very serious violation of international law. The only way to stop the Israelis is to resist their actions, but also it is required from the whole international community to impose sanctions on Israel.
At the same time, Palestinians held counter rallies across the occupied territories, waving the Palestinian flag and chanting anti-Israeli slogans. In Ramallah, the protesters said, although the Al-Quds is occupied by Israel and surrounded by military checkpoints, it will always remain their eternal capital, and the Al-Aqsa Mosque will always be a Muslim sacred site.
By allowing the settlers to storm the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, the Israeli regime is trying to divert attention from its internal conflict and shift attention to the Judaization of Al-Quds. But it will fail because Al-Quds always unites all the Palestinian people. Today, we're all united for the sake of the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Ahead of the march, in the morning, some 2,500 settlers stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in groups of 40 to 50 under the protection of Israeli forces. Following that, Palestinian worshippers were attacked and forced out of the compound by the regime forces.
Some around the world could argue that it's only a flag parade and nothing more. But for Palestinians, the flag march is one ugly face of Israel's occupation, domination, and seizure of their right to exist on their homeland. For Palestinians, Al-Quds is a red line, and they will always defend it with all means possible. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Iranian president says that 20 years of U.S. and NATO military presence in Afghanistan has brought the country nothing but war, bloodshed, and destruction. Ibrahim Raisi says that foreigners cannot care less about the security of the people of Afghanistan and the region. He said that foreign presence in the region has not led to regional security and will not do so in the future. He made a comment in a joint presser with Tajik President Emomali Rahman, who is on his first Iranian visit in 9 years. President Rahman said his country shares Iran's concerns about Afghanistan and backs diplomatic efforts for an inclusive Afghan government. He also called for access to southern Iranian port cities as a transportation link for his country. The president signed two memoranda of understanding and oversaw the signing of 15 agreements as part of what Rahman called a long-term roadmap for economic cooperation. The agreements covered the fields of energy, trade, transportation, and tourism. Time now for the news review section. NATO says it's no longer bound by past commitments to hold back from deploying its forces in Eastern Europe. The alliance's deputy secretary general says that Russia's decisions to attack Ukraine and halt dialogue with NATO show it has effectively moved away from the terms of a 1997 agreement between the alliance and Moscow. Now, under that agreement, the two sides had agreed to work to prevent any potentially threatening buildup of conventional forces in Central and Eastern Europe. Mircea Geoana said that the alliance now has no restrictions to have robust presence in the eastern flank to ensure its territory is protected. He did not give details of any planned deployment. NATO sent some troops to the Baltic states and Poland in 2017. It also dispatched reinforcements there following Russia's operation in Ukraine. Well, that was the introduction to the story we're going to discuss and shed some light on. So I'm inviting Greg Simons, researcher for the Institute for Russian and Eurasian Studies, joining us from Uppsala, Sweden. Also with us will be Samuel Geddes, who's a journalist, joining us from Melbourne. Good to see you, gentlemen. Now, Greg, this 1997 agreement that NATO is talking about, it's saying that the alliance and Moscow decided to prevent any potentially threatening buildup of conventional force in Central and Eastern Europe. Is this not what exactly happened? Is this not what the Kremlin was warning against? And that's why they attacked Ukraine? So, and now we have the EU accusing Moscow.
They've been breaching promises since the times when the Soviet Union was given a guarantee by the United States not to, and use their terminology, move one inch eastward if Gorbachev was given assurance, these assurances, they would not oppose the reunification of East Germany with West Germany. So, I mean, it even goes back to this. Now, if we go to 1997 agreement, I mean, this was meant to keep a relative stability and peace. And, of course, even if we go back to 1997, there were warnings that this was not going to be kept. And once more, I mean, this is a consistent thing with NATO. It does not keep its promises, or the US, more specifically, which controls NATO. Because you had an open letter written to Bill Clinton by a number of high-ranking officials, which warned of the consequences of NATO expanded eastward. Now, it's still doing this, even though there's a war going on as a result of this expansion.
Mm-hmm. Now, Samuel, how do you look at this story? I mean, whatever the reason was, people are suffering, people are getting killed, they're being displaced in Ukraine, Russian forces also getting killed, both sides. And then we have EU accusing of what Russia was warning against. So who's responsible for this insecurity in Europe?
Well, in most cases such as these, I would generally prefer not to exclusively blame one side or another, because as has been touched upon, this cycle of militarization has been used by both sides to justify their own military buildup. And as you just heard, the war in Ukraine is the inevitable result. So it's only going to make the outbreak of further conflict even more likely, and it certainly isn't going to help bring the war in Ukraine to an end. I would think that, I mean, for the states that proclaim to be supporting Ukraine and above all supporting the Ukrainian people, one could probably argue that the most helpful and constructive thing that they could do is to use their influence to push Ukraine to agree to a ceasefire, which it seems to be in much more dire need of than Russia, given its steady successes in the east of the country. Mm-hmm. So if we were to see if the fighting were to stop now, Ukraine would have only lost, I say only, lost the Donbass, the Crimea, and the small regions adjacent. But if there is no ceasefire, I think there is every possibility that Kiev may end up suffering the same fate as Mariupol and what we're now seeing in Severodonetsk. So I would say it is very much in Ukraine's interest to be trying to bring the fighting to an end peacefully.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Greg and Samuel, let's take a look at some reactions that have been posted on social media. I'll get back to you and we'll continue with the discussion. Now, the first post from Al Mayed in English says, with its obvious ambitions to expand towards Eastern Europe, it seems that NATO alliance has not quietly considered what is currently happening in Ukraine. Then Velina says that the Russian narrative on launching the war against Ukraine to prevent NATO's expansion collapsed with the application by Sweden and Finland for membership. Ukraine was invaded by Russia not because it was unilaterally striving to join NATO, but because it was a NATO member. Then the third post goes, a strong and independent EU with healthy relations with Russia is one of Washington's main strategic fears. Russia, against the background of NATO expansion, will provide its security with military technical means. We have a wide arsenal, and this is what the Russian Foreign Ministry says. And the next one says, time for the dissolution of NATO, withdrawal of all U.S. forces from Europe, and an end to the U.S. ideology, all for Democrats and nothing for other people. Now, Christine says, I know Russian expansionism is being touted by Johnson and Biden as the reason for the conflict, but it was actually NATO expansionism that caused it. Russia was only demanding neutrality, but Zelensky was trying to join NATO, as indeed Finland and Sweden are now trying to do. And another post goes that NATO was explicitly set up as a deterrent to Russian expansionism, but in 75 years of existence, it hasn't stopped any Russian invasion. It's only bombed tiny impoverished countries and made arms makers super wealthy and dictators super powerful. Okay, that's a good point. The last post, Greg, I just wanted to ask you, we know who is suffering. Also, the world economy, the global economy, especially Europeans are suffering. Energy, you know, prices are soaring. And, of course, that's not the only reason. The Ukraine war is not the only reason for that. As we know, they were already suffering from this, and it just got worse. Now, so, Greg, who is benefiting from this? I mean, why should NATO be now? NATO was, at the time, I mean, the raison d'etre for NATO's existence. Is it necessary anymore, because there is no more Soviet Union?
Well, NATO serves the purpose for the U.S. of enforcing the strategic imperatives which were given by Brzezinski about preserving or expanding American hegemony. So this is not about being a force for good or a defensive alliance. I mean, this has been proven on numerous occasions that it's not a defensive alliance. And so, I mean, this is an institutional mechanism for expanding U.S. influence and control. It's not to do with its publicly stated rhetorical purpose.
Okay, thank you so much for your comments. Greg Simons in Uppsala, Sweden, Samuel Geddes in Melbourne. Now moving on, Italy's two-time Prime Minister Romano Prodi has expressed serious concerns over the consequences associated with the Ukraine-Russia conflict. Prodi has warned that sanctions against Moscow would cost a lot, mainly to Italy, Germany, and the EU.
On Friday, two-time Prime Minister of Italy and former President of the European Union, Romano Prodi, had his say on the Ukraine crisis and subsequent geopolitical developments during a meeting with journalists held at the International Press Association headquarters in Rome. known for having overseen an extensive privatization of Italy's public assets and for his lack of ostentation. Prodi is today a retired politician. He expressed serious concerns at how the sanctions imposed against Russia over the conflict in Ukraine will reverberate through the European Union, with the risk of creating divisions among the members of the bloc.
The Ukraine crisis fallout will hit the EU badly. Sanctions would cost a lot to Italy and Germany, less to other EU countries. Brussels has reacted unitedly to Russia, but peace must remain paramount.
Italy and Germany are the countries which have relied on Russian energy the most over the past 20 years. Rome has been trying to diversify its energy sources, but it will take at least 2-3 years before it achieves a total replacement of Russian gas. Since the start of the war in Ukraine, Rome has been trying to wean itself off Russian gas, which currently accounts for over 40% of total gas imports. However, according to the National Bureau of Statistics, is that Italy's imports from Russia rose around 120% in value in April, while Italian exports to Russia showed an annual fall of almost 50% in the same period.
I have said many times that the impact of the sanctions against Russia will be completely asymmetrical. It goes without saying that the consequences on some countries like France or Spain will be milder.
Earlier this week, Moscow dismissed a plan for peace in Ukraine proposed by Italy. Also, Hungary has urged Brussels to call explicitly for a ceasefire in Ukraine. However, so far, some members of the bloc and the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen have adopted a hawkish posture on Russia, never making any mention of peace talks. Max Civili, Rome.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Economic divide.
The future of the world is at risk due to climate change. All scientific data points to that. In this part of the world, West Asia, the situation is in a crisis mode due to lack of water. Add to that Turkey's many dam constructions, and that is a recipe for possible conflict with economic ramifications. Hi, I'm Kaveh Tafwai. Welcome to Economic Divide. Coming up in this program, West Asia climate crisis. Lack of water is a result of that, threatening the regional economies. Obviously, climate change has contributed to a major portion of that. But there are other factors involved. We're going to take a look at Turkey's dam projects. What has it done? It has altered the flow of the rivers like Tigris and the Euphrates. The impact on countries like Iran, Syria, and Iraq. That adds to risk of regional tensions. However, Turkey looks at the situation in another way. It has a claim, according to how it sees it. It has a right to its water resources, and it's comparing its water to Arab countries' oil. Is it suggesting a swap?
In recent weeks, severe dust storms have disrupted daily lives in many countries in the West Asia region, including Iran, Iraq, and some Persian Gulf Arab states. The emergency situation in the region is part of the larger climate change crisis that is affecting different parts of the globe. The impacts could increase drought conditions, aridity, heat waves, and sea level rises. The severe weather conditions in the West Asia could seriously hamper the capabilities of the countries in the region to produce enough food. Decreases in food production and increases in grain prices could destabilize the already volatile region. Climate crisis was part of the reason why a war began on Syria in the year 2011. But apart from climate factors, man-made developments are also major factors in high levels of aridity and drought in the region. Turkey has been playing an unconstructive role in the current crisis. Critics say that it is restricting water supplies to Iran, Syria, and Iraq through dam building. The Euphrates-Tigris Basin is shared between Turkey, Syria, and Iraq. Iran also comprises parts of the Tigris Basin. Approximately 90% of the water flow in the Euphrates and 50% in the Tigris originate in Turkey. Recent political tensions in the region and the emergence of terrorist outfits have hampered collective efforts to tackle the crisis. The World Bank has warned that Iraq could potentially suffer a 20% drop in water resources by the year 2050. However, Turkey's massive dam projects have contributed to rising levels of drought in the region. Since the 1960s, unilateral irrigation plans, altering the flows of the rivers, coupled with political tensions between the countries, have strained relations in the basin.
When it comes to water resources, scientists have time and again warned not only about shortages that exist in many parts of the world, especially due to climate change, but also of the tensions that this would cause between countries who are vying for possession of the precious commodity. Now, this has given rise to the term water wars. Well, in West Asia, this is a matter of great concern, as evident in some of the online posts. Taking a look at our first post, Middle East and North Africa is the most water-scarce region in the world. Nearly two-thirds of the population are living in areas that lack sufficient renewable water resources to sustain current levels of activity and growth. Our next post, Iraq dust storm, flights grounded in Baghdad and Najaf. Skies turn orange. Dust storms have become increasingly common in the Middle East, experts blaming a combination of climate change and mismanagement of land and water, a lack of green areas. So that's how bad this area in West Asia is doing. Next up, Turkey. This tweet says Turkey has designed their dams so they can restrict water to Syria and to Iraq in order to make them more amenable to Turkish demands. Their officials have confirmed it. This is a continuation of this policy. And expanding further on Turkey's ambitions, the next post, Turkey is building dams to control and restrict the flow of water to northeast Syria. Now, digging deeper into this, Turkey proxies weaponizing water in northern Syria based on a report that has said Turkish-backed groups in northern Syria have weaponized water by building dams on a river that serves as a lifeline for communities living downstream in Kurdish-dominated areas. So a political motive there for Turkey. Then it goes on to say the SNA, or the Syrian National Army's blocking of a vital river during the region's driest summer on record, was a clear-cut example of using water as weapons of war. And finally, It goes to say the Khabur is a 320-kilometer long or 200 miles tributary of the Euphrates, whose source is in Turkey but runs across much of northeastern Syria and through Hasaka. All right, so there you have some of the tweets, which, by the way, are pretty informative from the people who are writing it. Let me introduce our guest for this section of the program. We have Ashok Swain joining us. He's a professor of peace and conflict research at Uppsala University, and he's also the UNESCO chair on international water cooperation, who joins us from Uppsala. All right, very good. Ashok Swain, welcome. The falling levels of the Tigris and Euphrates that you're well aware of, it warns of an impending water crisis. Countries like Syria and Iraq first, and then Iran also to suffer from this. And all three have actually accused Turkey of using its many dams that it has constructed, 22 on record, hoarding water along the Euphrates and the Tigris. How do you see this in terms of Turkey's ambitions here? Is Turkey guilty of hoarding the water and using it for political gains?
Turkey controls the upstream of Euphrates and Tigris River, and these two rivers are the main water supplier, at least to Syria and Iraq. The Turkey contributes almost 90% of water to Euphrates, and 10% Syria contributes. But the Tigris River is 40% of almost 40% Turkey, around 40% Iraq, and 10% 9 to 10% Iran. So those are the water contribution to the system. But country like Iraq, which almost get 90% of its water supply through these two rivers, 90% means Iraq's situation is almost like Egypt dependence on Nile. So I think it's a very important or the critical source of water supply, which is controlled by Turkey.
All right, let's bring in now Arnold Devalle. He's an international lawyer and geopolitical analyst who joins us from Damascus to tell us at least the Syrian side of what's going on. Arnold Devalle, welcome. So Turkish leaders previously to have stated that their country has a right to the water resources that are available in the region running through their country and being sourced from their country. And it actually has made a comparison to how the Arab nations have the right to their oil resources, and therefore Turkey should have that right for its water. Now, does this mean that maybe Turkey is implying or maybe stating indirectly that it wants to exchange water for oil, as it has stated? Previous officials have actually pointed to that. At this point, some are saying that that would mean that water is being used as a weapon.
As far as the Turkish leader guilty of basically implementing those kind of policies as concerns the water and basically what are natural resources belonging to sovereign states. Well, I guess the answer is in the question. I mean, all those resources are part and parcel of sovereign states. And as far as I know, there hasn't been any redrawing of borders. So what we are witnessing is essentially a cynical ploy by the Turkish authorities, obviously for internal political reason, to, in thus far as northwest Syria is concerned with the refugees, alleviating the burden on the Turkish economy. As you know, the Turkish economy has not been doing very well. The Turkish lira has been plummeting up by 75% the last 18 months. And so this is part and parcel of this kind of, you know, I'm going to go outside my own borders and fix internal problems by exporting it into not only into neighboring states, but also by accaparating natural resources so I can fulfill this project of somehow, and that goes to the heart of the question, expanding. Because let's not forget that the ideology of the Turkish government is that of neo-Ottomanism, which bears on reclaiming parts of what used to be the Ottoman Empire.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
Countries across the West Asia region are facing a bleak future when it comes to its water resources, brought on by climate change. In this in-depth section, we will look at the destructive effects and whether there are other factors that are exacerbating the situation. Well, when it comes to the West Asia region, it is home, first of all, to 10 out of the 17 countries that are currently facing extremely high water stress, experiencing things like declining rainfall or what's called desertification. The region is also experiencing soaring temperatures. Now, as you're about to see, this is a direct result of climate change, which has gripped many parts of the world, not just unique to this area. Even if global rises are limited to 2 degrees Celsius, average summer temperatures will rise by 4 degrees Celsius by the year 2050. And then we need to take a look at the consequences of these temperatures. Well, they're going to lead to increasing evaporation of things like the surface water, because it's forcing an over-reliance on things like aquifers. Again, this is the section of the ground that's been broken up for us to explain this, and groundwater supplies that are already at risk of over-exploitation. And that is, of course, something that's gripped many countries in the region when it comes to over-exploitation. Now, moving on, let's take a look at some of the stats that we have gathered from, in this case in point, the years 2003 and 2010. And we're going to take a look at the Tigris and Euphrates rivers and the loss. In this case, we're going to take a look at Turkey, Syria, Iraq, and Iran that are along the Tigris and Euphrates river basins. They've lost a lot of water. The figures vary, but they're estimated to be around 144 cubic kilometers of fresh water, of total fresh water that has been lost. And 60% of that loss was attributed to the pumping of groundwater from underground reservoirs. So that's quite a bit of water to have been lost. Next up, Turkey's Southeastern Anatolia Project. That is what it's called. They're really all over the place in terms of what Turkey has done. It's the largest and most controversial dam building program in the world, 22 dams that are either constructed or slated to be constructed along the two rivers and Turkey's borders that are with Syria and Iraq. Now, Turkey's dam and hydropower constructions on the Tigris and Euphrates have been estimated to cut water to Iraq by 80% in terms of Iraq, and then to have cut water to Syria by 40%. These are big numbers. Obviously, some of the consequences, it has jeopardized agriculture and natural habitats. Okay. Now, Syria itself has also been directly impacted by Ankara's dam-building project. Now, in this case in point, we're taking a look at what happened during the year 2006. That was very severe in terms of the drought that came upon Syria. And the devastation it caused for agriculture began from that year. And then, of course, the Turkish dam building contributed more to that. In terms of what it did, it forced large numbers of people into cities like Damascus. And it also has been linked to the social upheaval and unrest that led to the big social unrest of Syria that happened in the year 2011. Okay, now we're going to take a look at water withdrawal. That's the next issue that needs to be tackled in this whole notion of water resources not being available for the region. Let's move on to about water withdrawal in order to understand how Turkey's dam building has affected regional countries. So in terms of that issue, by 2011, Syria's total annual water withdrawal as a percentage of internal renewable water resources had reached 160%. For Iraq, it was 80% and 20% for Turkey. Obviously, these numbers have been are estimates, but they're quite a bit when it, when you take a look at the amount, percentage-wise, of water withdrawal that has been done from underground, things like aquifers, for example. Now, on to the next issue, and that's about control that Turkey has over the Tigris and Euphrates. The Euphrates River, Turkey controls 90% of it, Tigris 44%. Obviously, when you have that kind of cards stacked for you, then there's a lot that you can do in terms of the control and what you want to get from that. Now, when it comes to control, Turkey holds almost all of the cards on this issue. Take a look at the percentages here when it comes to the Tigris and Euphrates. The Euphrates River, 90% control of the water flows that Turkey has control of. And then the Tigris, 44%, big percentages. Now, what kind of advantages does that give Turkey? Well, unfortunately, this is what Turkey's been accused of. Unfortunately for Turkey, that is. It has been accused of manipulating water scarcity, further its political agenda in terms of what it's doing. It's been accused of that. And also, Turkey has been accused of trying to become a regional water superpower. And, of course, that brings with it some advantages for Turkey, but how it goes about that and how the countries in the region are going to react to that is what the key question is over here. Let's talk about this a little bit more with our guest, Arnaud Devalier, who's an international lawyer and geopolitical analyst, joins us from Damascus. Arnold, welcome back to Economic Divide. Let's take a look at what we're seeing here, the falling levels of Tigris and Euphrates, which obviously is an impending water crisis for countries like Syria, Iraq, and Iran, which have all accused Turkey of using their dams along the Euphrates and Tigris to hoard the water. Is Turkey guilty of this accusation that's been leveled against it?
Well, I mean, the humanitarian law depriving civilian population from access to food and or water and all basic necessities can be considered a war crime and or crime against humanity. Now, what one needs to understand is that this participates of a strategy that goes back to the Jeffrey doctrine, and which has been reiterated by somebody from the Pentagon who's exclusively tasked with this situation, at least in thus far as Northeast Syria is concerned, which is to basically deprive Damascus from all access to oil, wheat, and water, as it turns out. So this is just a part and parcel of the hybrid warfare.
Wow, interesting statement there. Well, let's find out from Ashok Swain, who rejoins us. He's the professor of peace and conflict research at Uppsala University. What he thinks about some of the hoarding that Turkey has done. Ashok Swain, welcome back. Countries across West Asia, obviously, as we've said, they're facing a bleak future in terms of declining rainfall and lack of resources as a result. Climate change, obviously, is part of the reason over here, but also Turkish dam projects. What are your thoughts on that? Doesn't that pose existential challenges for the countries of the region?
It is getting more and more serious. As you know, there have been for the last decade and a half or decade, so at least the internal situation in Syria and Iraq was not good or was not conducive for them to demand or to agriculturally develop or to economically take a sustainable progress because of the internal conflict. But that has changed to some extent, to a large extent. Iraq has stabilized to a greater extent. At the same time, Syria is moving into some kind of peace and some certain kind of cessation of hostility, at least. And I think they need demand. They need water. They need water for certain kind of, and also Iran. There is an issue of the demand for the increasing demand for the water for their own agricultural needs, for the drinking water, and all sort of other human resource, human health and development.
When it comes to the issue of dam building by Turkey, it's not just Iraq and Syria that are angered by Turkey's hoarding of water. Iran has faced frequent droughts in recent years, caused in part by climate change as well as dam building in neighboring countries. Tehran has said Turkey's upstream dam building on shared waterways was unacceptable and has called on Turkey to cease such activity. This was in particular in reference to the construction of dams on the Aras River. Tehran has loudly expressed its opposition to Turkey's dam construction on the border water resources, with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs saying such a Turkish move is not acceptable. It's worth taking a look now at the specifics of Turkey's dam building and the dangers that it poses to other regional countries. Over the past 50 years, Turkey's state hydraulic works, known by its Turkish acronym DSI, has been very active. It has built 22 dams and 19 hydropower plants on the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. The effect on downstream rivers has left large parts of Syria and Iraq in severe drought. Over the last two decades, the DSI also has been taking up water resources on both the Kura and Aras rivers. Compared to the projects on the Kura, Turkey has built a greater number of dams on the Aras, though with a lower capacity. From 2012 to 2014, Turkey constructed 6 hydropower plants on Aras and is currently planning 8 more. And potentially larger projects are still in the queue. Among these, the recently announced Soylemez Dam particularly stands out, with a planned height of 113 meters and a carrying capacity of 1.4 billion cubic meters. The project would create the 4th largest reservoir in Turkey. Iran's Department of Environment has already warned that Turkey's move to construct Ilisu Dam over Tigris River would pose a serious environmental threat to Iraq and eventually Iran by reducing the entry of Tigris water to Iraqi territory by 56%. Given all the challenges that exist behind Iran's water availability, Iran has not stood still and has aggressively tackled the problem. Iran has gone ahead with a project to desalinate seawater from the Persian Gulf and supply it to the arid areas across the country. The first phase of water transfer from the Persian Gulf to Kerman and Yazd provinces has already been inaugurated. And finally, Turkey's dam-building projects have not only affected regional countries, but also villages and towns inside Turkey, like the 12,000-year-old town of Hasankeyf.
I've seen the new city. I could never love a place like that. I'm from here. These caves are my home. My past is here. My roots are here. It is in these caves that my home resides. For me, luxury is not a house with all the comforts and latest trends. For me, luxury is this.
This ancient southeastern town is now completely submerged underwater. With the construction of the Ilisu Dam and along with it, the heritage and culture of this town, along with memories and the local population. That's the end of this segment.
In conclusion, it is abundantly clear that West Asia is facing water challenges, which poses potentially existential challenges for the countries of the region. That's right, existential. Well, the most critical problem, water security, is affected by the Tigris-Euphrates river system. Now, Turkey is controlling the distribution of this water, and as such, well, it can use it for its own political gains. We've said that. But it is up to regional countries to pressure Turkey diplomatically into working out a viable solution which can benefit all countries involved. That does it for this edition of the program. Thanks for tuning in, and thanks for being with us. For Mikhail Vitakhvi and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents. For humanity. سيد عبد الله الموسوي.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at human dignity, and we said it is the essence of the human being himself, and all other rights are in fact trying to preserve that essence of him. One of the things that we see when we look at the Islamic teachings, when we look at the Quran, for example, or we look at the words and the traditions of the Prophet and Ahlul Bayt alayhim salamullah, again, we see that they give the human being a lot of value. Not just value, but in fact, a lot of value. Why? Because obviously, if we have to go back to the beginning, he was the only creature that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has ordered his angels to prostrate to. And you all know the story. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala made the heavens and the earth under his command and for his service. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala also gave him and made him the carrier of the trust, or as we call it, al-amana. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala chose him to be his vicegerent and to be his leader on earth. And through these things, we can see that this human being is being glorified and honored by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to such a state that no other creatures has been given such value and such honor. And then we get to look at the point where we say, well, since Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given the human being all these things, and Allah has honored him and dignified him, now, does the human being himself has the right to devalue, degrade himself or not? Or should he or she try to elevate themselves and make sure that what Allah has given them stays? Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, when he created the human beings as a body, obviously, he gave it the soul. And the body deals with materialistic matter, and the soul deals with the spiritual aspect of him. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wanted the human being to preserve his spiritual side, because through his spiritual side, all these things that we've mentioned that Allah has given to mankind is preserved. If a person tries to neglect that spiritual aspect of him, he degrades himself to the state of animals, as the Quran says. Now, what happens when you live in a system where it forces people, either directly, indirectly, consciously, subconsciously, it tries to bring a person's spirituality to zero and turns him into a materialistic animal, a person that only cares about food, drinking, eating, having a partner and chasing money and chasing this world. And then all the honor that Allah has given him goes out of the door. Because now, sadly, we live in a system, or at least in a world, where spirituality means nothing, or at least is frowned upon, or even not even considered to be
to say the least. Or if someone wants to practice it, they will be labeled as crazy, or at least, you know, as we call them, cuckoos. Now, what's going on here? I mean, where are we heading? Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala glorifies me. He gives me all these divine aspects, and someone else wants to take it away from me and degrade me and takes my dignity that Allah has given me. Is that correct? Is that even allowed? Let us take a break and then we'll continue right after.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters. And you are listening to the program For Humanity, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. So as we said, that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, when He gave me all these things, He wanted to be preserved. He wanted to be protected. Human value, for human dignity, His respect needs to be maintained. Now, we live in systems where now it's becoming systematic in a way that there are people, and not just one, two, there are entire systems trying to work and try to deprive the human being of all those values that Allah has given them and turn them from a human being that has value and worth to something worthless. Let's look at the West, for example. When they looked at women, they turned them into an object, whether it is to sell a product or to sell women themselves and turn them into a sexual objects. Now, that is degrading females, taking them from a point where Allah made them so high, and those people bring them down. Or when you look at males, for example, they've been turned into batteries where all they do is work and try to make sure that they're paying Big Brother, if we can say the least. So they are no longer have the value of a human being as well. And the children are being turned into batteries in the making, basically. So they teach them, they educate them, but their education is only to teach them how to perform a certain task when they grow older. They don't teach them to think. They don't teach them to be free thinkers. They don't teach them to create and innovate and become, you know, changers of life. No, the education system that we have, it just teaches you how to perform a certain job once you get older. And you choose that job. Either you want to be a doctor, we'll teach you how to manage that. You want to be an engineer, we'll teach you how to manage that. But do I become a free thinker and choose for my own? No, of course not. Now, that's a problem. Now, human rights, it's not just to make sure that I have food or I have the essentials like power, gas, or water and this and that. Sometimes, as a human being, I'm better off without all these things. I would rather live in a desert without having all these, you know, things that they think they're giving me for free, or at least they have provided me, which is, I mean, nothing is for free these days, and maintain my dignity and maintain my self-value. I don't want a person to turn me into a human being that is just a vegetable, or as these days we call them, zombies. It is our right to navigate ourselves through this world and navigate this world by ourselves. I should not be turned into an object or advertisement for someone else or for someone else's product, which is what they're doing to us. So we are the great creatures of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, great creation of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We need to maintain that. We need to maintain this dignity. Sometimes me and you, subconsciously, we turn ourselves into what the West wants us to be without realizing. So we need to at least wake up and try to say to ourselves that we are human beings. We are glorified and dignified, and we need to keep it as such. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.